It has been a great day as we have had the opportunity to worship God together, and then at the close of our services today to appoint Brother Mark Taylor as an elder of the congregation here. We're so thankful for his desire to serve, and certainly as he asked us this morning, we want to be praying for him, praying for the other elders, letting them know how much we appreciate them. They are involved in a thankless job often, and we don't let them know that we appreciate them nearly enough. And so I want to encourage us to make sure that we make their work a joy. I was teasing with Mark before services this morning, and I was congratulating him, and he was saying, well, just wait, we're not there yet. And I said, you know, when I think about someone wanting to be an elder, it makes me think of James and John and what Jesus had to say to them. They were asking for those seats of the right hand and the left hand, and Jesus said, you don't know what you're asking for. And I think sometimes those who desire to serve as elders, they don't know what they're asking for. But maybe that's a good thing, because we can't take it all at once. But day by day, we can serve, and we need men who are willing to serve, families that will help and encourage. And I know that we'll want to support our good elders and help them, keep them in our thoughts and in our prayers, and certainly make their work a great, great joy. You know, I was in one of our children's classrooms today, and I saw a poster, and I thought this was pretty good information. The poster says, let's get along, and then it gives these suggestions. Use kind words, be quick to forgive, listen, share, think before acting, encourage others, take turns, talk it over. That's pretty simple stuff. And yet you practice things like this, and it'll go a long way in helping our elders to have a work that is a joy unto them. And so we appreciate those who serve as elders, those who serve as deacons, those who are Bible class teachers, and all as servants unto the Lord. I want us to open our Bibles up to Revelation chapter 14. That's where we're going to spend our time this evening. And I want to share with you a lesson that I've entitled, Babylon is Fallen. That's really what you see in chapter 14. You know, in chapter 12, when we go back to it, you see this image of the dragon trying to fight against Christ, but he is not successful. And so he's going to turn his attention to the church, and he's not able to destroy the church. And so he is going to attack individual Christians. And when you get to chapter 13, you see the allies of the dragon, of the old devil. You see the sea beast and the land beast that we talked about last week in our study. The emperors, the personification of that empire, and how they set themselves up as gods and demanded worship and praise and sacrifice being given unto them. And then the land beast being the group of priests that forced others to practice this kind of reverence unto the emperors. And it looks like the church is going to be overwhelmed. How can anyone stand against the devil, against the dragon and his allies, against Rome and these priests or this cultic group that supports this worship of the emperors? What are the Christians to do as they are sought out and as they are persecuted? Well, the answer is chapter 14. And in chapter 14, very simply, we're going to learn that those that stand with Christ are victorious. Yes, the enemy will continue to persecute, but don't let that deter you. You keep being faithful unto God. And yes, there will be many of you that are called upon to lay down your lives for the cause of Christ. But you will not lose your eternal reward if you remain faithful. and the cause of God will be vindicated. His kingdom will stand, and Rome will be judged and brought down for her iniquities. Now, I said that in just a few sentences. The drama that is given to us in chapter 14 is much, much more beautiful as it's played out for us. Remember, these are visions that are given unto John to teach these messages unto the Christians of the first century and all that would follow, that we need to continue in faithfulness unto the Lord, and that those who would oppose the Lord's kingdom will suffer his judgment. So let's look here in chapter 14. Having spoken of these allies of the dragon, the two beasts there, it seems like the church is in a very precarious situation. What's going to happen? Verse 1, "And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written in their foreheads." The last thing that we noticed in chapter 13 is that those who had worshipped the beast were given his mark. But those who are faithful unto Christ bear the mark of God. Back in chapter 7, when we're introduced to this 144,000, they represent the church, the faithful church upon the earth. But now they are with the Lamb. Now they are triumphant. They're on Mount Zion with the Lamb, with the Savior. And they have overcome. They're not identified with Rome. They're not identified with the beast. They are identified as belonging unto the Lord. Verse 2, "And I heard a voice from heaven, as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And they sung, as it were, a new song, before the throne and before the four beasts and elders. And no man could learn that song but the 144,000 which were redeemed from the earth." Here they sing this song, a song that is known only to them. Their voice is so powerful, so loud. It's like the rushing waters or the great thunders. But it's so harmonious. It's like the strings of a harp. Have you ever been in a large gathering of brethren? When we sing songs of praise unto God, I think about going to some of our colleges and going to the lectureships, and there are a few thousand people there, and being able to sing together. Or maybe I think of our young people going to something like CYC and the songs that are sung. How beautiful are those voices. How powerful they are. And here's the idea of these redeemed, the 144,000 representing the triumphant church, are able to sing this song that's known only to them, only to the redeemed. Folks, do you realize that when you are part of the redeemed, you are part of the greatest group that anyone could ever be a part of? To be a member of the Lord's church, to be a member of the family of God, is the greatest honor that anyone could hope to have. I know we have groups that are exclusive. You know, and it's hard to get in. Well, what's the name of that group that's made for geniuses? They sent me my membership, but I just can't remember them. Mensa. Oh, you got to have a certain IQ to get in. You have to be in the 98th percentile on that IQ test or above to get into that group. But folks, to get into this group, all you have to do is obey the gospel of Jesus Christ and continue in faithfulness to Him. And the greatest reward, the greatest honor, is ours. And here they sing this song that only those who are redeemed can know. These, the writer gives us more information, these are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. As he identifies them here, he's not talking about their physical standing. He's not talking about people who have never married and kept themselves physically pure. It's symbolism here. And the idea that they are virgins is that they have always remained faithful unto God. Often throughout the scriptures, the idea of faithfulness to God is talked about as this idea of purity. And becoming unfaithful to God is the idea of spiritual adultery. These, this 144,000, and again, that's not a literal number, represents the church here, the triumphant church, but these have kept themselves pure. They have always followed the Lord. They haven't compromised themselves, and they speak no lie, no guile. Of course they've been tempted. Who wouldn't be tempted to simply say, Caesar is Lord? I don't mean it. Maybe I have my fingers crossed behind my back. I'm not going to live that way. And they don't even care. All they want me to do is burn this little bit of incense and make this declaration, and I can go on my way. But these would not do that. They've kept themselves pure and holy, devoted unto God, and they will not lie. There is no guile in them, and they are without fault before the throne. Beginning at verse 6, we see a series of three angels coming onto the scene. The first one we read about, verse 6 beginning, "And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people, saying with a loud voice, Fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come, and worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters." The eternal, the everlasting gospel. Remember what the word gospel means? Good news, good tidings. That's what this angel is proclaiming, the good tidings. Now, it's not the gospel of Christ. They already had access to it. But this good tiding is of the judgment of God, the vindication of his cause. Rome is going to be brought to an end. God allowed Rome to continue in their persecution against the church for a period of time, but it would not go on forever. And now they will have to pay. Because of their rebellion against God, because of their arrogance, God is going to bring judgment upon them. And no, it's not good news that people are suffering, but it is good tidings that God's cause is being vindicated. And folks, remember, God is just as righteous in his judgment as he is in his mercy. And here the angel proclaims this good tidings, this good news. So worship God. Don't worship the emperor. Don't worship idols. They didn't do anything. They didn't bring this earth into existence, this universe. Serve the eternal God, the one and only God, who is the creator of all things. The second angel comes forth in verse 8, and there followed another angel saying, "Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication." Babylon is a code name for Rome here. Babylon was known for its arrogance, for its rebellion against God, so much so that God not only determined to destroy it, but to destroy it in such a way that it would not be rebuilt. And here Rome has shown itself to be of that same kind of nature. It's rebellion, it's arrogance. And so God will bring judgment against Rome. And this judgment is so sure, so certain, that as we read these things, the angel is able to declare that Babylon is fallen. Not that it's going to, but that it is. Because in the mind of God, this is a done deal. They'd had their opportunity to repent, and they would not. Not only would she suffer, but also the nations that drank the wine of her wrath, the others that she had involved in her iniquities. Verse 9, the third angel comes forth, and the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, "If any man worship the beast and his image, and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night, who worship the beast and his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name." And so the third angel announces that God's judgment is to come upon all of those who have worshiped the beast. And that worship is spoken of in these terms that are just awful to imagine. It's the worst thing that you can possibly think of as this eternal suffering, eternal fire that those who bore the mark of the beast would be made to suffer. It's a reminder, really, to the Christian, to the servant of God. Yes, they would be tempted to compromise. Here, you are at the point where you're put on trial, where you are asked, "Are you a Christian?" All you have to do is say no. All you have to do is speak a curse against Christ and swear your allegiance to the emperor, and nothing is going to happen to you. But if you don't do that, you might be fed to the lions. You might be burned at the stake. You might be crucified. God wants them to know, Jesus wants them to know, that to compromise is not the way of escape. That's not the way to get out of this situation. Because if you do that, here's what's going to be your punishment. I was reading this past week a little bit about Pliny the Younger, who was a ruler during the second century, who had been given a position of authority by Rome. And he writes back to the Emperor Trajan, because he doesn't know exactly what to do with Christians. No one's ever told him. Nothing's ever been sent out. And so he says, what do you want me to do? And then he explains, here's what I have been doing. What I do is I ask these Christians a first time, and then a second time, and a third time, if they are followers of Christ. And if they deny it on any of those occasions, I let them go. No punishment. But if they persist, I put them to death. Trajan writes back and says, keep doing that. That's a good job. That's a good idea. Now, I know that's my paraphrase, but that's basically what he tells him. Earlier in our study of the book of Revelation, we mentioned a Christian by the name of Polycarp, a Christian who was burned at the stake for his faith in the second century. You don't read about him in the Bible. We read about him in secular history. One of the statements that's made by Polycarp doesn't get as much attention as the other one that he made about being faithful to God, serving Christ for 86 years, and he's not going to turn away from him. But Polycarp evidently was threatened, not only by the beast, but by being put to death at the stake, being burned alive. And evidently what he said was this: "You threaten me with fire which burns for an hour and is then extinguished. But you know nothing of the fire of the coming judgment, an eternal punishment reserved for the ungodly." I think that's exactly what this third angel was talking about. And he was reminding these Christians, compromise was not the way of escape. Faithfulness was. Yes, it might mean your very life, and yet it'll be over in just a little while. It's temporary. What is to be avoided at all cost is this eternal punishment. And so this warning is given. Verse 12, he reminds them, "Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus." You keep being faithful. You endure until the end. Verse 13, "And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, Write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, and their works do follow." Jesus was letting Christians know, you keep being faithful to me, you endure, and rest is what waits for you. You can't help but think about Jesus saying, "Come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." This term rest carries with it the idea that they shall be refreshed from their labors, and the labors carry with it the meaning of toil under great adversity. You'll find rest unto your souls for those who die in the Lord. You know, a lot of times we look at this verse, we kind of pull it out of this context, and we use it at funeral services, and we use it to encourage each other in faithfulness, and rightly so. When you see it here in the midst of chapter 14, where the Lord is revealing all these things unto John, and John is writing them down, it carries even greater significance when you think about what the church was going through, what these Christians were facing. And they're reminded that the blessing is for those who die in the Lord, not for those who compromise, not for those who seek a way of escape from this physical persecution, but those who continue faithful to the Lord. Folks, when I study these things, a thought comes to my mind, and I imagine it comes to all our minds as we think about them. What would I do? What would I do in those situations? I'd like to think I'd be faithful to the Lord no matter what. But I know thinking that and actually doing it can be two different things. Peter, he thought, I'll die with you. Jesus says, you'll deny me three times. And Peter basically says, no way. That is, everybody else might, not me. And then he does the very thing he said he never would. Now, evidently later, Peter is given another chance. And again, the Bible doesn't reveal this to us. Not in direct way anyway, does let us know that Jesus, well, he tells Peter that you're going to be led where you don't want to go. And so when he was speaking of his manner of death, evidently an execution, and Peter remained faithful to the Lord. I'd like to think that no matter what, I pray, and I want to keep growing in that way. I also pray that we're never in those situations. How thankful we need to be that we live in a land where we have such freedoms. Folks, you realize, if I was preaching this lesson 2,000 years ago, it would mean my life. If I was preaching this lesson 500 years ago, it would mean my life. How thankful we need to be. And so he encourages Christians as they go through these things. God's judgment is coming upon Rome. Now, verses 14 on through the end of the chapter to verse 20 gives us a picture of this judgment. It's not the final judgment, not the day when the Lord comes again, but it is God's judgment against Rome, this enemy that is fighting against the church. And it's really given to us in two pictures. Two pictures where an angel cast in a sickle and the harvest is brought forth. It's a judgment scene, one of grain and one of grapes. And it's really speaking of the same judgment. They're not two judgments that are being described here. It's just one. It's just described in these two ways. And I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and upon the cloud one sat like unto the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. There's a temptation here to think of this as being Jesus, one like unto the Son of Man. And evidently, the editors of the King James Version thought that it was because Son is capitalized. But I want us to understand that this is a reference to an angel. You see, in Revelation 14, Jesus is already a figure. He's the Lamb that stands with the 144,000. He's already here. And so here is an angel that is being spoken of. And in apocalyptic literature, this is the way angels are often spoken of, one like unto a Son of Man. And so an angel is here with this sickle. Verse 15, and another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him that sat on the cloud, thrust in thy sickle and reap. For the time is come for thee to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. And he that sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. And another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven, he also having a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar which had power over fire, and cried with a loud cry to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, thrust in thy sharp sickle, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. And the angel thrust in his sickle into the earth, and gathered the vine of the earth, and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden without the city, and blood came out of the winepress, even under the horses' bridles, by the space of 1,600 furlongs. And so here is this time of judgment, the angels with their sickle, and they're reaping a grain harvest and the harvest of the grapes. Again, this is speaking of God's impending judgment, the doom of this enemy of the church, of Rome. And when God brings forth his judgment and the grapes are harvested, it's not the precious juice of the grape that comes forth, but instead it is blood. Now, folks, a lot of people, you know, try to literalize all the things that are spoken of here in the book of Revelation. Here is one of those examples where if you do that, it's simply ridiculous. 1,600 furlongs. Well, that's 4 squared, 16, times 10 squared, 100, and you get to 1,600 furlongs. 4 is the number of the earth. 10 is a number of completion. And so you have a judgment that is complete upon the earth, upon this enemy. But 1,600 furlongs is about 184 miles long. And up to a horse's bridle is about 6 feet. They're still searching for a place in Palestine where they could have a river of blood that deep. You just can't find it. But that's what they want to try to do with this, instead of understanding that this is being revealed to us in symbols as you think of the judgment that God brings upon Rome, how complete it is. And that's the idea of these angels with their sickles bringing judgment upon this enemy. A couple things for us to keep in mind as you think about chapter 14. Number one, keep your focus on the eternal. It's so easy for us as we go through life here upon this earth to get bogged down with just everyday living. In the parable of the sower, Jesus even talks about those who allow the word to be crowded out by the cares of this world. And if you let them, it will. It will. But we can't do that. Our focus needs to be on the eternal. And you see that in this chapter where they're reminded, you keep being faithful. I realize, Jesus is saying to them, I realize the difficulty you're going through, the hardships that you're facing. I know. I see them. But don't try to escape for a temporary reward. You escape punishment here upon this earth. You escape death here upon this earth just for a little while. You're going to die of something. And so don't settle for the temporary. That's what the devil is always tempting us to do. Settle for temporary pleasures rather than holding out for the eternal reward. But our focus needs to be on the eternal. That's the mindset we need to have. You see it back in Revelation 2 and verse 10 when Jesus told the church at Smyrna, "Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give thee the crown of life." And you see it again in 2 Corinthians 4, verses 16 through 18, where the Apostle Paul is going to write, "For which cause we faint not, but though our outward man perish, yet the inward man is renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment." That's a key, folks. It lasts for a moment. It's temporary. First time I went to Costa Rica, there was a man whose name was Randy Edwards. He had been there a lot of times. And he had told me about some of the situations there. Hotels aren't like here in the States. Accommodations aren't like they are here in the States. And so you go through different things, and maybe you don't have hot water that week, or maybe you don't have a pillow that's worth anything, or your blanket is just a sheet that maybe you don't have air conditioning, whatever. His saying always was this: we can stand on our head and eat peanut butter for a week. Now, I've never tried that, but I suppose you could do it if you had to. For a week, and then it's over? You can do anything. That was the point. You can go through anything when you know that it's temporary. And that's what the scriptures are telling us. The struggles and difficulties that we face here upon this earth, they're just for a little while. You just keep holding on. You focus on that eternal reward, not on the here and now. He says, "For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. That's where our focus, Christians, needs to always be. And then think of this idea when you think of Revelation 14. Their works do follow them. In particular, verse 13, those that die in the Lord, they'll have rest from their labors, and their works do follow them. They'll be rewarded according to their works. But I think about that idea in a different way as well. The idea that here, a person's works follow them. We leave behind us an example. And those deeds that we've been involved in, those works that we're involved in, they speak to others. Are they good works or are they evil? Let me give you a couple of examples. You think about someone like David. King David, I know he wasn't a perfect man, but he was a man who sought after God. And often, when kings of Judah showed themselves to be faithful to God, this is what was said of them. Something along these lines. Like we read in 2 Kings chapter 18 and verse 6, these are things that are said about King Hezekiah. And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord according to all that David, his father, did. I don't know how many grandfathers David was unto Hezekiah. You can count that up. But David's work were still speaking, still following him. Hezekiah served the Lord like David, his father. But you know, the opposite is also true. In Israel, there were no good kings, and all of them followed after their first king, Jeroboam. These happen to be words that were spoken of a king by the name of Jehu. The text says, "But Jehu took no heed to walk in the law of the Lord God of Israel with all his heart, for he departed not from the sins of Jeroboam, which made Israel to sin." His works were still speaking too, but they were evil. What kind of steps are we leaving for others to walk in? You know, the Apostle Paul would write about marking individuals. And most of the time when we think about marking someone, it's a negative. But there are times when he talks about marking someone in a positive way. You mark and you follow them as they follow Christ. What works will we leave behind us? And will people be able to follow them to heaven? Their works do follow them. Chapter 14 tells us of the judgment that God was going to bring upon Rome. Babylon is fallen. She had fought against the Lord and against the church. He had been long-suffering with her. The time was up, and God's judgment would come. Babylon was fallen. My friends, God has been long-suffering with us. I hope that we've taken advantage of the long-suffering of God by obeying His will. And if you have, let's keep faithful. Let's focus on the eternal. Let's make sure our works are good. Let's do our best to lead others to Christ. And let's keep holding on, looking forward to that great reward that is reserved for those who are the redeemed. And if you're one who hasn't yet taken advantage of the long-suffering of God, He's given you this opportunity because He is long-suffering. And so if you're subject in any way to the invitation of heaven, we want to encourage you to come as together we stand and as we sing.